Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB, your official broadcast partner of the Kansas City Chiefs, who are getting ready to head down to Jerry's World in Arlington, Texas, to take on the Dallas Cowboys on the late Sunday afternoon game coming up this weekend, a big game. And we are pleased to be joined now by right tackle Mitchell Schwartz. First of all, Mitchell, how you doing, man? Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great. I want to jump right in to I was gonna give this big flowery intro about, you know, how great Mitchell Schwartz is playing and all that. But then I thought, you know, instead of having somebody take my word for it, I'll just quote some guy on Twitter by the name of Jeff Schwartz. Same spelling as your last name. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not.
Kind of a funky first name spelling, though, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the G off, yeah. Jeff.
A little weird.
Yeah, it is different. He is a big fan of yours on Twitter. A lot of tweets to go to, but he starts off by saying, "Hey, Mitchell Schwartz, did Von Miller play tonight? Asking some all-pro voters." That was after the game against the Broncos. He also tweeted out, "Last two games, Mitchell Schwartz versus Khalil Mack and Von Miller. Not a finger touched on Alex Smith. He's underpaid." What's it like having a representative like Jeff Schwartz out in the Twitter sphere, you know, talking you up after all these games?
Yeah, I mean, it's great. You know, always good for some free publicity. He doesn't charge for that stuff, so that's always fun. But, I mean, it's great to have, you know, family that supports you like that. He does it very well on Twitter. He's got a big audience, so that's kind of cool. And, you know, obviously from when he was here, he's got a big Kansas City crowd that follows him as well. So there is a lot of overlapping there, but my whole family's always been really supportive of me, and, you know, I just really appreciate it. And like you said, it's cool to have kind of a hype man like that.
He is a serious hype man. I will say this, too, in all seriousness to our listeners, fantastic follow on Twitter, Jeff Schwartz, and it is G-E-O-F-F Schwartz. But he breaks down all kinds of NFL games. He gets really dialed in, though, on the Chiefs games. I think, you know, he's got a vested interest, obviously, in that his brother plays for the team. But you're giving him some great material right now. I mean, those two guys, Khalil Mack, Von Miller, considered maybe the two best edge rushers in the league, and your quarterback doesn't get hit in those two games. What does that make you think as a right tackle when you hear people, you know, put numbers out like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. I mean, as an offensive lineman, you go into the game and you got a pass-blocking goal and a run-blocking goal, and in the same instance, you don't want the guy to get touched, whether it's the runner or the passer. So it's pretty hard to do. I mean, it's you know, especially against guys like that, you have to do a lot of preparation, and it's a pretty stressful week, you know, watching film and seeing what they can do on film. And then you take your game plan to the field as best as you can, and you just go out there and play ball. And you know, we were, especially this past week, pretty fortunate in that we got the big lead, and it kind of tempers their pass rush a little bit, and we don't get into those situations at the end of the game where we got to throw the ball and make up, you know, 15, 20 points, and they're not able to pin their ears back. So, you know, that's a testament to, I mean, Marcus started it off with the strip and the touchdown there and getting us on the board. So it's kind of a team thing. It's funny, you know, when you think about my job as a pass protector, you know, how much the defense ties into that. I mean, they're able to get us that lead. We're able to go get a touchdown. It's 14-0 or 14-3. I forget what it was, but that really changes the complexion of the game and allows you to be a lot more balanced on offense. And like I said, not get into those situations where they're just pinning their ears back and they know you got to throw it.
Yeah, it was 14-0. Then we had the Tyreek Hill pass play. You know, it ended up being 14-3 after that. Have you gotten to work any? You know, I'm trying to think, like a tackle eligible type thing where you get to be involved in any of these trick plays.
So much tape on my hands, I don't think I could throw the ball or catch it that effectively. And even if I caught it, you know, I don't know that the downfield speed matches Tyreek's quite so much.
Yeah, hungry pig, right? I'm just putting it out there. You know, maybe we get Mitchell Schwartz a touch or two. You know, you be for it?
Yeah, I mean, you never know, but you know, I'll just keep doing whatever they tell me to do.
Yeah, which is keeping Alex Smith clean, as we talked about. And another thing your brother pointed out, but it's something we've been talking about for the last couple of years, man, the position of right tackle is a tough job as it is, but in this division, man, I mean, you've got Justin Houston, Joey Bosa, Khalil Mack, Von Miller. I mean, you're gonna see three of those teams twice.
Yeah.
That's not, I mean, Do you like that? Do you say, "Hey, I want to go against the best," or do you say, "Man, this is going to, you know, this is a grind, man. I'm getting judged by going against maybe three of the best pass rushers in the entire league in my division."
Right, and I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, it's obviously a great test, and you like to see how you fare against the best and how you match up against them. You know, you look at the overall schedule, you look at the pass rushers, and you think, "Wow, there's not really a break in that schedule at all." And you know, it's sometimes not that. That's kind of the thing, though, I think, that the NFL is migrating towards is there aren't teams without pass rushers, and
right.
Especially edge guys. And you see it more. I mean, you list all those guys, but all those teams have a guy on the other side who's almost just as good, if not as good. I mean, the Chargers have Ingram. The Broncos have Shane Ray and Shaq Barrett. Khalil Mack is paired with Bruce Irvin. And then all those teams have one or two key backups at that spot. And so that's kind of the evolution of the NFL is you know, as I think the offenses get a little more spread out, a little more pass-oriented, they've countered with speed and speed rushers and guys who can get to the quarterback quick. And, you know, as the ball's getting out quick, they need guys who can get there even faster. So that's kind of the way the NFL's going is just, you know, tons of pass rushers and, you know, puts the both tackles at a premium like you're mentioning. I think, you know, the whole right tackle, left tackle thing's a little antiquated. And you got to, like you said, I mean, I'm blocking three of the best guys in the NFL six times a year.
Yeah, it is. It is funny that you say that. You know, the left tackle, right tackle thing being antiquated, because it seemed like it wasn't that many years ago that the adage was, if you were going to take five players, you know, and put all your money in having great players, of course you'd start with quarterback. You got to have a left tackle. You got to have an edge rusher. You got to have a shutdown corner. It seemed like those were the things. And now, why is it? All of a sudden, is it because of the partnering thing? But like, I just listed off all these great edge rushers, and they're going up against right tackles maybe more often than even the left tackle is.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, I think back in the day, a lot of stuff was under center, so you did get a true drop back where the quarterback shoulders are a little more turned to the left side.
The blind side, is
right,
what you call it.
Right, you know, everything's, I mean, probably 70-75% of passes are from shotgun these days, and the quarterback's got vision on both sides, so he's able to see it. You know, I'm sure as teams, like you said, invested in that left tackle and put all their premier guys there, opposing defenses figured, why even put my best rusher against a guy who might get one or two pressures a game? Let's put him against the other side where, you know, theoretically there's a worse blocking tackle there and he's able to get some more pressure. And, you know, as you see it, the quarterback can have his back to the left, but if he's looking left, he's got no vision on the right. I mean, we see all those guys you just listed off, they get their strip sacks, and the quarterback doesn't even see it. So depending on where the quarterback's looking really determines his blind side. It's not really where the shoulders are turned. And, you know, those are two reasons right there why, like you said, the left tackle, right tackle thing's a little bit outdated. And, you know, I think that's, like we just talked about, the progression of the league. I mean, even interior guys now, I mean, you look at those guys inside and, you know, they're animals in there. They got guys who are 320 who run 4.8, and you know, the pressure up the middle they're figuring out is a big deterrence on a quarterback and being able to feel it up the middle. And so they're really just trying to get to the quarterback any way they can.
Is it is there a chip on the shoulder of the collective right tackles in the league because of that antiquated notion that the premier guy's on the left?
You know, I think so. I mean, it's not necessarily a chip on the shoulder. I mean, you look at the pay scale, it's completely out of whack in terms of, you know, the responsibilities of the tackles are pretty similar. And, you know, it's starting to change in the past year or so in terms of right tackle salary. But, you know, that's just kind of the way the NFL has been for a while, and so you understand it. But in terms of, you know, I don't think we have a chip on our shoulder, but I do think that, you know, when you look at, say, Pro Bowl voting and things like that, it's typically six left tackles. And, you know, like I said, we share a lot of the same responsibility, and so I think the job at the end of the day is extremely similar.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you about the relationship with Alex Smith as your quarterback, because I was watching a video leading up to the game against the Broncos in which, I think it was Lewis Riddick, was breaking down Trevor Siemian's pocket awareness, or lack thereof. I'm not asking you to comment on another quarterback, but it made it clear to a layman like me that, boy, the quarterback's sense of where the pocket is can lead to sacks and to pressures and things. And then it made me think about how Alex, he seems to have a good pocket awareness, but he also is a guy that if things break down, he's going to take off and run. And I'm putting myself in your perspective with my back to him, trying to protect him. He could be going anywhere. What's that like? I mean, does that matter for you, the fact that you don't know if Alex is breaking out? And just tell me maybe how that relationship goes between you and a quarterback and knowing where he is and him knowing where you're going
to
be.
Yeah, I mean, for every play, you know essentially where the quarterback's supposed to be in the pocket. You know, we see the shorter passes, he's probably not as deep, and some of the deeper shots, he gets a little deeper. And you know the general guideline of where he's supposed to be. And then, like you said, you know, the quarterback movement, maybe he has to slide up a little bit to the left or the right, depending on, you know, external factors. And when he breaks contain and flushes out and starts running, I mean, you feel it from your defensive end. The guy stops rushing and then starts to disengage and try to run. At that point, the big thing is not getting a holding call. I mean, if you're latched onto the guy and he's tearing away from your body, you have to, you know, kind of figure out that point where you need to let go and you need to understand what's happening. But, you know, you're not blocking for multiple spots. I'm not blocking for a guy who's sitting in the pocket and a guy who's 20 yards outside the pocket. I think you just do your best to protect him where he's supposed to be. And then if the defensive lineman starts making a reaction late, you adjust to it. You kind of know what's going on. But, I mean, in Cleveland, you know, we had Johnny. We had a couple other mobile quarterbacks. And you get used to it. Like I said, you block for where they're supposed to be at the start, and then you do your best to adjust based on whatever's happening.
We're visiting with Mitchell Schwartz, who's having a fantastic season at right tackle for the Kansas City Chiefs. And one of the stats that I saw, this one came from Pro Football Focus, that you've had more one-on-one pass pro situations against the elite pass rushers in the league than any other right tackle and any other tackle by far over the past couple of years. That goes back to what we were talking about. You're going up against these guys in the division. But it made me think a little bit about how with Pro Football, your brother tweets out Pro Football Focus stuff a lot. We, you know, in the media, I feel like we get the player grades from Pro Football Focus all the time now. And it's, on the one hand, I think it's really cool that we can get some, you know, quote-unquote experts' evaluation position by position of players, but it's just one person's evaluation at the end of the day. It's still really subjective, and that evaluator doesn't even really know what play call you guys have going on. As a player, how do you feel about the advent of things like Pro Football Focus and those things out there that are putting, like, grades out for you for the rest of us to kind of consume and look at as gospel, you know?
Yeah, I think there's definite good things that come with it. You know, I know there are a lot of players who are very against it and, you know, don't feel like it encompasses what they're doing on the field quite well. But, you know, I think there's a lot of value to it. Like you said, at the end of the day, you know, they're not exactly sure what your responsibility is on any given play. And, you know, I know that some tackles have talked before about their quarterback saying, hey, make sure the guy rushes inside on this. I'm going to run outside the pocket. And, you know, that looks like a pressure on film, but you don't know that that's tied into what the quarterback's telling the tackle. You know, Pro Football Focus, their argument is that, you know, over 1,100 plays in a season, if they misgrade 5 or 10 of them because they don't know what's going on, I mean, that gets lost in the data. There's so many other plays that the pure volume of what they're grading, you know, generally fleshes out who's performing well and who's not. So, like I said, I think there is definite value in it. You know, their job is just trying to determine, did you do your job? They don't care how you get it done, how it looks, any of that stuff. Essentially, did you block the guy or not? And they've come a long way in terms of how they're grading. You know, like you said, it's one guy grading. They do, I think, 3 or 4 different grading processes throughout the week. So they put out the grade right after the game. And, you know, this past week's a good example. You know, after the regrade, some of the pressures that I was given went away. So they do those things where they keep checking up and grading it and having multiple eyes on it and trying to do as good of a job as possible. So there's definite value there. You know, I don't think you want to put all your stock into it. You know, it's a starting point for saying, in general, is this guy playing really well? Is he playing average? Is he playing poorly? And, you know, for evaluators in the NFL or in the scouting world, obviously you're watching your own tape too. So you're making your determination. Hey, does this match up to it? But it can also uncover guys who aren't playing or who are playing really well, who are under the radar, guys at, you know, positions that you wouldn't think of, and you say, hey, you know, that tackle's up there with Joe Thomas and Jason Peters and these other guys who are great tackles, and, oh, wow, he's got a great Pro Football Focus grade. Maybe I should watch his film and see if that matches up to it. So it's really cool at, you know, unearthing things like that. And like I said, I mean, there's definite value to it. It's not something you're going to hang your hat on and say this is the definitive grade on the guy and that's what we're going with. But you just understand that that's a jumping-off point.
It sounds like you're aware of it, though. Like, you know, you knew that they changed your grade or whatever through the course of the week. So a lot of guys pay attention to it, sounds like.
Well, I mean, this particular case, it was either my brother or friend told me that they gave me a few extra pressures than I thought I'd given up on the week. So, and that's another argument that people have is against it is that, you know, they put out their grades 30 minutes after games, and it's based on the TV copy, and people want to consume those grades after games. I mean, they want to see how their favorite players did and who's playing well on what team. And, you know, so the negative to that is that if they look at that, they just get locked into that grade. They're not going back on Wednesday after the regrade or whenever that is and saying, oh, well, this is how we really fared. You kind of get locked into that first impression of what the grading looks like. And I think that's, you know, one of the arguments against it.
I like it because as a fan, when I watch the games, I have my own opinion of how or perception of how I think a guy played or didn't play. But I'm watching the whole game, and sometimes I can go look at it and think, maybe I missed something, or you know, maybe, oh, that backs up exactly what I thought. And it's just kind of interesting to see what, you know, somebody else who's dedicated to watching each guy thinks about it. It's kind of fun. Let's change it over to some more fun stuff here. We're visiting again with Mitchell Schwartz. I know from your book that you wrote with your brother that you're a foodie.
Yep.
And when I don't know if it's still out there. When I pulled
food
up,
truck.
A taco truck was outside. And that's really hard for me to, like, walk right past a taco truck and not order some food. I had to come sit down. Food truck. You're a big food truck guy or no?
Oh, yeah. I think the food truck craze, I think what they're doing is they're taking traditional stuff that, you know, kind of simple. I mean, tacos are simple, and they're putting their own flair on it. And, you know, if someone's doing a food truck, you're pretty certain that they're pretty dedicated to that craft. And so if it's something as simple as street tacos, you're pretty confident they're going to do those really well. And a lot of the food trucks are kind of trying out new stuff and fusion and, you know, finding new ways to make tacos. And, food trucks are awesome. I mean, I think that's been great. And then, you know, they all have their little apps, and you can track them around the city and figure out where they're going to be. And it kind of gets a little cat and mouse game. And I think it's a great thing for the food industry.
If you're out at like a festival where they get one of those ones where they got like seven or eight food trucks, what type of food truck are you not walking by without buying? Is there like one type of food you got to have if you're?
That's a great question. I would say I'm a sucker for funnel cake. And
okay.
So if there's like a dessert food truck that's selling funnel cake, you know, I don't think anyone makes funnel cake at home for themselves or go to the market getting some frozen funnel cake. So I think that's always a good kind of like fairish food where you walk by and you go, wow, I haven't had that in a while. I bet it's pretty good. And,
you know, it's hard to mess up. I feel like it's hard to mess up a funnel cake, but
it is. I think I've had a couple of pretty poor ones, but I think those were at like, you know, the pier or somewhere else, and I think those were pre-frozen. And
You can't have that.
It's got to be fresh.
A guy that I went to high school with has a funnel cake truck, and he's been on some of those, you know, Food Network shows and all that stuff. I go straight powdered sugar. I don't do any of the toppings. Do you do any toppings on
it? No, I'm with you on that. Powdered sugar is all you need. Like you said, I mean, if the funnel cake's good, you don't need all that stuff.
Right. It's fried dough. I mean, you know, put a little powdered sugar on there. That's all you need. The other thing I have to ask you about is cupcake the palm. Look, I know you've talked about it. You've done news stories on it. I'll admit I was late to the game on this. The staff had to kind of tell me a little bit about this. So I go look it up. And at first I was feeling really embarrassed because I have like 2,500 Instagram followers. Cupcake has 84,800 Instagram followers.
Yep.
But you only have like 3,000.
I know.
So the dog is like infinitely
way more famous than me. Absolutely.
How did this happen?
Well, so we got the dog a couple of years ago now, and you know, he's a cute little pup, and you know, my fiance made an Instagram account, you know, kind of in his image, and you know, at the time, you know, it seemed a little silly. You know, some people would give us some comments every now and again, and you know, you don't really expect to see an Instagram account from a dog's perspective, but as you can tell, there's a big following for cute little pups, and we love ours, and I mean, Cupcake's a great dog, and we love having him, and you know, it's kind of cool to be able to have photos of him, put him up there, you know, kind of do the captions in his name. And you know, as you could probably guess, I'm not the content creator of that account. My fiance does a great job with that, but she's been doing a awesome job finding cool pictures and putting them on there, and you know, kind of figuring out the Instagram game and building the huge following. I mean, 2 years, 85,000 followers, that's great. And you know, we have fun with it, and just you know, another way to connect with, you know, people around the world. I mean, they do those Instagram stats, and you know, the second leading country in followers is Brazil. I mean, who would have guessed that there were so many Pomeranian lovers in Brazil? But it's cool to be part of that.
Well, so and we were talking with Shark Kendrick West a couple weeks ago, and he's got Shorty Low. That's like a miniature wiener dog, I think he said. And it just kind of strikes me because I think the stereotype is these big mean football players, they're going to have like Rottweilers or Doberman Pinschers, some kind of big intimidating dog. You guys have the little tiny dogs, you know, a Pom and a is that look, if you're a big football player, you don't have to go intimidate people with a big dog. Like
no,
what is
no,
it?
No. Well, you know, I had grown up with bigger dogs, yeah. and, you know, that was something I trended towards, but my fiance had always wanted a Pomeranian, and, you know, yeah. with how much we travel, and at the time we were in Cleveland, we just had a small apartment, a bigger dog didn't make sense, and if you're going to get a small dog, you might as well get a small dog. I mean, yeah. Cupcake is about 5 or 6 pounds, depending on what he's eating. Yeah, wow. That's it. He's a lot of fluff, a lot of fur.
Yeah, so if you pour, like, a bucket of water on him, he just disappears, oh, right?
Turns into nothing. But, you know, like I said, if you're going to have a small dog, you might as well get a small dog. And he's easy to travel with. He's easy to take around. It was easy to have an apartment. I mean, now we got yeah. a house, and he's got a lot of room to roam. So, yeah, a lot of fun. I think... You know, like I said, as someone who had only had bigger dogs, the small dog is definitely a lot of fun. And for people that are on the fence about that, I'd say go for it.
Yeah, I grew up with big dogs, ended up with a Cocker Spaniel that I actually found here at the sports complex years and years ago. And wow. I was like, you know, this is actually pretty nice. I mean,
yeah.
a little more portable, you know, easy, you know, lap dog. It's, you know, it's kind of nice.
Yeah, and believe it or not, with all the fur, he's not a big shedder. I mean, we never really? Find fur around the house or anything. And, you know, pretty lucky from that yeah. perspective as well.
That comes in handy. All right, Mitchell, I've kept you long enough. I really appreciate the time. One final thing. Look, you got a big game against Dallas Cowboys coming up. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your thoughts maybe on going to Jerry's World. World, the big dome there, and maybe a thought or two, just what do you think are going to be a couple of the keys in getting another big win in this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's always fun to go down there to Dallas. I mean, like you said, Jerry's World, it's a huge place. I think I played there once, and the odd thing is how huge that Jumbotron is.
Yeah.
So when you're sitting on the bench, you're so far underneath it that you can't really see it. You got to look straight up, and by the end of the game, your neck starts hurting. So I learned to just kind of look straight ahead and just judge what happens on defense based on how the crowd's reacting and not really look at the screen too much. But in terms of the game, I mean, they've got a really good defensive front. I mean, the front four is doing really well. You know, they're really active. They've got a lot of sacks. I mean, Lawrence on the edge, I think, right now is leading the league in sacks, if not in the top two or three. So he's done a great job. And, you know, the whole defensive line has, I mean, they rotate guys in, and they're all doing well. They got, you know, four or five linebackers in there with Sean Lee is kind of the point man for that. And that front seven, I mean, they play great defense. Like I said, they're active. They're able to move around, but they're also not just pure speed. I mean, they've got a lot of power. They can really bring it to you. So you got to bring a lot of physicality against them. And then just got to be on point with your assignments.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I know it's another big game. I mean, everyone is. When you guys are in the fortunate position that you are competing for maybe the best record in the AFC, that makes every game big, which is a lot of fun. And it's a lot of fun catching up with you too, Mitchell. And I'm hoping that I'm going to be, you know, watching your brother brag like crazy again on Sunday because you're having another great game. Thanks a lot for the time, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, that's Mitchell Schwartz. We will be back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB.